Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Phil Beverly, Amara Anya, Mike Miller, Chris Roebling, and Roger Stone. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to tweet us a comment, it's @Dumo, @DUMO. Or if you want to join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video each and every week, it's beyondthebeltway.com. And we've got a great panel for us this evening. A little bit later on in the second hour, we'll be joined by Roger Stone, who's always a man in the news, and he'll be bringing us up to date from his perspective about what's happening with the CIA and the intelligence and Russia and everything else. We'll be interesting to those comments. But also our guests in studio will also offer their thoughts. And Chris Roebling, you're one of our card-carrying Republicans.
Yes.
You're also a commentator for WGN Television in Chicago.
Guilty.
My comment to you is, of all the things that are going on, and there's just a lot going on in Washington,
yep,
what is the issue that intrigues you the most?
I'm very disappointed with the performance of the Trump White House. You know, I've seen this rodeo before because I, not that I'm old or anything, but I was around in 1981 as a congressional staffer when Reagan took over. I certainly was watching closely in 1995 after the big 94 reshuffling of election in which Newt Gingrich became Speaker of the House.
America.
You know, and so I've seen the Republicans charge the ramparts now twice, and I've certainly been in a lot of conversation. I don't think that the Trump White House has learned a lot from either 95 or 81. I don't think they've learned a lot since the campaign. I think they're stumbling, fumbling. And that starts with President Trump, right? The only person I don't really see in this picture is Mike Pence, which says a lot of good things about Mike Pence. But you go down from there. I mean, these people are saying crazy things on TV talk shows or on interview shows, whatever. And I just don't think they've got themselves down to that kind of discipline that is needed by a White House to lead a national discussion and the evolution of the issues that favor them.
Amara Anya, do you agree that any political leader has got to solidify his or her base first? And what Trump is really doing since he's been sworn in is solidifying that base. Are they upset with him at all?
Well, I'm just excited because I completely agree with what Chris said. I mean, I totally think that the White House thus far has shown a lack of discipline. They have been fumbling since day one. Again, an organization is a reflection of its leadership. I think this is a product of Trump's leadership. I don't know that the focus should be on solidifying the base now. I think you really have to make sure that the ship is stable and that it is functioning like a well-oiled machine, and they have not done that. And I think if they don't do that, then they're going to have a lot more work in their hands trying to solidify their base.
Mike Miller, question to you. You're an economist at DePaul University for many, many years. Mm-hmm. The budget, the first Trump budget has been floated. Your reaction to the budget and the broader question, does he have to continue to work on solidifying his base?
He does, and one way he will solidify the base is through this budget because he's calling for a bunch of cuts in things that his base want to see cut. And he wants to expand what his base wants to see expanded, an expansion of the military and a cut in the support for the arts and so forth. It is only a cut, from what I understand, of about 1.5% total of spending. And a couple of us around this table are in higher ed. We know what cuts are like and how hard it is to deal with those cuts, talking cuts in the double digits, not single digits. So the fact I think the country can take such a cut, and he can show what he thinks is important.
Phil Beverly from Chicago State, you are a Bernie Sanders Democrat. Is this administration worse than you expected or better?
They're pretty much what I expected. It's an administration that has no governance experience and shows it pretty much every day in the missteps that they have. As soon as they try and capitalize on something that they might do well, like the speech before Congress, they find a way to fumble that away and do something stupid, right? Like tweet out that, oh, Barack Obama bugged Trump Tower in New York. I don't have any evidence of that. And then when called on it, well, I tweeted it, but I was told something else. It's like, come on. Do you have to have better leadership than that? That's ridiculous. What occurred to me just recently is I'm wondering if there's actually a shadow White House in operating sort of under Mike Pence's guidance, because this is a guy who's got governance experience. He's a disciplined enough politician to know, no, you don't say that stuff. And so when GCHQ, for example, was accused of wiretapping the president, and they fired back and said, no, how dare you? Don't go there. And we apologized. Well, part of us apologized, and then part of us doubled down on the stupid thing that was said before. So it makes me think that wherever the apology emerged from are the adults in the room. And hopefully they will become ascendant here quickly.
Will that rub the president the wrong way if there is others that make this suggestion, as Phil just made, that that Trump is there's an end run going around Trump by the staff? I mean, how is he going to react to that?
Well, he will explode and start tweeting again or something crazy like that.
Something crazy.
Yeah. But I want to make the point that it is time for him to get also beyond his base. I mean, his base is vitally important. But I think that it is incontrovertible that after this guy won in North Carolina and Pennsylvania, Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin, no one at the Republican National Committee said, okay, Mike, get out there to those states and find out what those people care about. Because he got a margin of support there, Bruce, that people who may never have voted, may have always voted Democrat, maybe voted Republican for a while and then lost faith in the Republican party. But he has to embrace those people and other people like them, because he has to worry about building out his coalition. And so when you get to, I disagree with Mike about some of these cuts, nobody wants to see Meals on Wheels. I mean, that is a own goal. It probably shouldn't be with the federal government. They probably do a lousy job at it. There's probably money wasted at it. It's like a feather compared to this mountain of waste or mountain of spending over on the entitlement side. So these guys are going after domestic discretionary with no storyline. And that's really what they've done, unfortunately, also with Obamacare. I think the storyline is completely frayed.
But you end up with thousands upon thousands of feathers, and they all add up to a very large amount of money. There's just certain things that government should be doing and certain things it should not be doing, and this is one time that we can begin to put our foot down and say these are things that government should not be doing.
In 2017, I don't think anybody cares about the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, NEH, NEA. I mean, there's the diehard leftists, but they're going to be disappointed, and we're going to be happy because those are going to be zeroed out, and they should have been 50 years ago. But, well, maybe not 50 years ago, but they should have been 20 years ago. Anyway, programs that help indigent people who cannot take care of themselves are not the place to start fiscal rationality.
We got to pause. By the way, we lost a great talent. Chuck Berry passed away. We head to our first break by presenting probably one of the greatest driving songs ever.
Historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school. Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back. It's pretty hard not to want to dance when you hear Chuck Berry. I got to tell you, I'm an old man now, but boy, I love Chuck Berry.
Do you hear Bill Bennett today reciting Johnny B. Goode with absolute fidelity to the original script?
Wow. Chuck Berry was just absolutely phenomenal. Huge. You've got a couple of stories.
John Lennon.
We'll divert from the important issues to talk about the culturally important
issues. Two quick points. John Lennon once said, if you want to call rock and roll something else, you could call it Chuck Berry. Number two, my son went to St. Louis University. Great school and a great city. It was also the hometown for Chuck Berry. Mm-hmm. And he still appeared throughout his 80s. He appeared once a month at a club in the Del Mar Loop down in St. Louis. And no one knew when it was going to be or when they would let the tickets open, but there were only like 80 seats there. And my son tried for 4 years. He never got a ticket. But there are people who saw Chuck Berry just 6 months ago, you know?
Chuck Berry, you got a Chuck Berry story?
Just an innovator.
Your father knew Chuck Berry. You were too young for Chuck Berry.
Too young, but my dad and my mom and dad grew up in that era.
Yeah,
came of age in that era, and speak fondly of him and those innovators from that era.
He was a giant.
I want to come back, get back to our political discussion, and during the last segment, you talked about the points in the budget that you think the Trump fans will be supportive of. Let's talk about some of them, because let's first of all talk about the arts, because they have received a lot of publicity as well as Meals on Wheels. But is it your position that public broadcasting and the arts should receive no federal funding,
yes,
Professor?
That would be my position. It certainly made sense back when there were only three networks and the bandwidth was so narrow and people didn't have access to television the way we do now and internet and so forth. This is not something that the people, many who are very much in need, should be spending money on. It is something that benefits mainly upper middle class and middle class people. If I could say it directly, it affects mainly white people. It is not something for the average person. It is, to me, it's a waste of money, and it's a philosophical position. There are just certain things the government should not be doing. And I know that, for example, that Meals on Wheels, my father, when he was an invalid for the last 10 years of his life, and I was just a little boy, and Meals on Wheels came to help him, and that was great. But it was a local Lutheran church that was running that. It wasn't federal government doing that. And again, that's where that money should be coming from. It should be coming from you and me. We should be giving the money for that to be done, not the federal government.
Amara, how do you where do you weigh in on this issue about what role government has and is Trump onto something by pulling funds from things that could be funded by other sources?
I question where they're starting with these cuts. I actually don't think that things like Meals on Wheels and even supporting public broadcasting should be at the front of the line. If they want to make a statement based on principles of the Republican Party, I think there are other more effective ways, at least based on Republican principles, that they can make adjustments to the budget. This, I think, sets them up to be for a lot of negative responses, because it's like, why focus on Meals on Wheels first? Like, why are these things at the front of the line of the other things that could be cut from the budget?
Subsidies to the sugar industry.
I agree.
Subsidies to big oil, for example.
And those never get talked about.
Part of the reason they never get talked about is because the press is out to delegitimize and ultimately depose Trump. And so they're not going to get into stuff that would in any way assist him. But is that in the budget?
Are there cuts to corporate welfare in the budget?
They must be. If they're not there now, they should be before final passage.
And also the timing. There isn't a lot of time. Like, we have 4 years. I mean, I think that if they really wanted to make a statement and have some major impact, the priorities as far as what they focus on is key. And if it was cutting corporate welfare, right, those are things you can make a huge statement on up front.
Immediately.
As opposed to one feather after another. I mean, how many years will it take to get enough feathers to make
a goose?
But two things. Yeah. One, with the economy at full employment and going along the way it is, this is exactly the time the government should be cutting.
Do you think the economy is at full employment?
Well,
we were just saying for years under Obama that we've got this huge bulge in the folks who are disaffected and have left the workforce.
We'll discuss that in a moment. Let me just finish. And the other thing is that I'm disappointed that Mr. Trump did not begin any kind of process to go after Social Security and or Medicare.
Well, yeah, we knew that.
These are the two things that are absolutely going to bankrupt the country. I know.
He said that he would not do it.
I know.
And right. Whereas Obama said he would and didn't. Trump said he would not, and he hasn't.
And I just don't understand. That's where the big money is. If you want the big money, that's where the big money is. And we're going to go broke because of it.
Is there a way – this is a toss-up. Maybe I'll let you take it first, Phil. Is there a way for Trump to get beyond the Russia CIA story, the allegations that he made against Barack Obama? Is there any way to put that in the rearview mirror, or is that an issue that the national media, they're into the president like a pit bull, and they are not going to let go of this issue? No matter what comes out of the investigations tomorrow, they're not going to let him forget it.
No. Because the allegation is there. The Soviets, I'm cold warrior. The Russians interfered with the election. It happened.
Allegedly.
They did. Because we do it. So we got to assume that they do it. We can't be mad that they did that, though. We really can't. That's hypocritical on our part.
I understand
that we do the same thing. We interfere in elections all over the world. We can't expect one of our main competitors not to do that. So the first thing we need to do is just admit, yes, they did.
Okay.
Did it happen to have any effect? Exactly.
That's another question that we would only be able
to know depending on the extent of the interference. That will only come about through...
But part of the reason
there's no public evidence. The intelligence community has agreed. The 15 agencies that make up the IC have agreed that there was Russian interference in the election. Now that they haven't revealed what that evidence is, they can't.
Part of the reason why we can't move beyond the talk about Russia, I think, is part of it is from the what I see as incompetence and dishonesty from members of the administration. So when there are falsehoods that have been told, these are unnecessary mistakes that have been made. When you're not up front, you're not forthright, and then you get caught up. So, of course, the media already looking for things is going to pounce on that. And then the other is making statements saying that President Obama wiretapped Trump. I mean, it's almost like you won't let the issue die.
Look, guys, I think I'm coming around. I have been saying he should have started with tax reform. Okay,
absolutely.
I'm beginning to think he should have started with infrastructure, because I think it would have been harder for some Democrats to oppose infrastructure program that was actually going to bring jobs and real jobs. You know, this kind of thing. Regardless, I think the blast off of this administration, these first 100 days, have been really choppy, okay? And I do think he can get past the Russian thing because it's a nothing
burger. Advise him. What should he do?
Step one, throw away Twitter for the time being.
Okay.
Not going to happen.
Step two, focus on a message per day. Create message discipline that is going both for a tactical achievement in a given week, according to the congressional timeline, and also a strategic achievement over several months.
But will that message hit home if the national media and some in the Democratic Party are like pit bulls and they're not going to let him forget what he said and charged about wiretapping and Barack Obama?
It ain't
going to happen.
Here's the good part about Twitter. It enables him to go around, but he can't go on Twitter about Barack Obama tapped my phones and is a bad person. What an idiot. Yes. And then he stands up next to Angela Merkel, who is not my world's most favorite world leader, but, you know, she's a pretty big deal. And for him to jokingly refer to the fact that the United States of America was tapping her mobile phone is to me a loyal Republican. And I was not a Trump guy, but I mean, you know, I sort of if it's Trump or Clinton, I know where I am, and you guys have got to make up your own mind. But I'm telling you, for him to get up there next to her and to do that is outrageous. And I wonder where he is going to be on some major issue,
and
such as North Korea.
Your advice is going to fall on deaf ears because he does not have the psychological makeup to follow that kind of advice.
I'm not so sure. Very few people in the world can walk into a city like Chicago, put down $450 million, and leave 4 years later with a 90-story gleaming skyscraper as he did. He is capable of higher-order reasoning, but he has to fire Ernst Priebus. I mean, Priebus is failing as chief of staff. There's no question
in
my mind.
But then how does that alienate the establishment?
It doesn't alienate anybody. Reince does not have a big, chiefs of staff come and they go. Yeah. And they are there to serve the president. They're not there to be representatives of some outside constituency.
Reince Priebus
is not managing our White House. And that's bad for Democrats, Republicans, Independents, everybody.
But he's also not managing the president. If the president
does, I
can't believe that Reince Priebus is saying, hey, why don't you go out and tweet some more?
Why
is Kellyanne Conway still on TV?
Okay. Why
is Sean Spicer still?
I agree, but the question is, who would replace Priebus? Who can manage this president, and who can do it effectively? I mean, right now,
his son-in-law, probably,
perhaps, or maybe his daughter. But right now, who would be able to step into that role? Who can rein things in?
Who's got the relationships with Congress? Who can manage the relationships with the cabinet and all those executive branch agencies?
Who will take the job working for Trump?
Exactly.
Right.
That's a tough ask.
There are people out there.
His daughter should take care of him and let Mike Pence take care of everything else. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast. And border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont. Calls when we come back from Chicago.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes. Another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger. Two if you're very overweight. And three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. By the way, let me announce to everyone listening within the sound of my voice, we received a text during the commercial break that Roger Stone, who is an associate of the president's and author of the book The Making of the President, 2016,
shocked
that he will not be able to join us tonight after I've been tweeting out all day that he's going to be on this second hour. He is not going to be on the broadcast. He is scheduled to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. This is my interpretation. He is scheduled to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee. He was in an automobile accident last week. Some suggested that it might have been an attempt on his life. I wanted to discuss that with him.
By Ann?
It's question. There was questions about it. So these were some of the things that I wanted to discuss this evening. Again, he was on the show a couple of weeks ago, said he would like to come back. We booked him for tonight. Again, why he just chose to cancel, I don't know, but I wanted to let you know early in the broadcast, in case you're standing by waiting to hear Roger Stone, I will be honest with you and say that we will not be able to deliver him this evening. But since he's not here, let's talk about him.
Yeah.
And he can listen to us
talk
about him.
Well, but Roger, that's a limp effort on your part, wherever the hell you are. Excuse me. I say that as one of the Republicans.
Let's talk about the seriousness of the relationship between the president, some people around the president, the intelligence community, and the intelligence that a president gets. That's an important communication. Does everyone at this table believe that the intelligence communities, and I mean communities because let's go back several years, that the intelligence communities perhaps on some occasion have sent to the president not information that is absolutely wrong, but may have been interpreted in such a way that it has a political bent or bias to it. Does everyone
think that could happen? Like uranium in Niger or something like that?
As one example. I mean, the general sense, well, what's your thought?
I agree.
You spent some time in the CIA in the early years.
I think there are people there. They're very loyal, very dedicated Americans, and they work very hard, and they care a lot about their jobs. But I also think that there are factions within the intelligence agencies. It's impossible for there not to be, especially on the intelligence side. You have science, you've got operations, you've got administration, and then you've got intelligence inside the central
analysts.
Yeah. So these are the analysts. These are the people who are very, very expert. And you know what? They're people who could walk out and be, you know, professors at colleges.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Many have PhDs.
Absolutely.
Huge library at the CIA. These people tend, I think, over time have become more and more what we would refer to as liberal. That's not to say they're out to get Trump necessarily, but there are currents within those agencies.
Your reaction, Amaro?
I think it's plausible. To me, the bigger issue, I think, is the an almost delegitimizing of the intelligence agencies, because if there's a disconnect between the president's stance and the intelligence agencies, I think that presents problems. And this particular administration has established a disconnect, but it's not coming from the intelligence agencies per se. I think it's coming from remarks that the president has made and the way that he's handled and engages with the intelligence community.
No, but the Trump people would argue that the intelligence community or some in the intelligence community have dropped a dime, have spread information, derogatory information that has embarrassed the president. Now, the president did say, you know, early on he made reference to early in his administration, might have even been before he was elected, you know, during the transition period, when he made a comment about the intelligence that had been presented. He said, well, is that the same group that gave us, you know, weapons of mass destruction, which the political left has talked about for 15 years now. So the question is, who started it?
It's more complicated than that.
Well, tell us.
The president has to rise above sort of those feuds. If he's going to lead, then he needs to lead. And he needs to set aside and stop making comments like that and denigrating folks who work, I make up, really hard and are really dedicated, patriotic professionals. And there's people there who will work to undermine, just like I'm sure there were people there who would work to undermine Barack Obama and undermine George W. Bush and undermine Bill Clinton. There are people in every
because
agency
bureaucrats
who would do that.
Like to undermine the leader because the bureaucrats will be there. Presidents come and go.
Yeah.
Mike Miller.
Let me look at it from a non-professional, just a plain old citizen standpoint. NSA lied through their teeth to us, through Clapper. Are they keeping all this data?
Yes.
I don't know if I believe anybody. I'm sorry. I've gotten to the point, and I have not been this way until the past couple of years. I don't know who to believe in the government at all. I don't know if Mr. Trump actually has something. And he's going to tell us this week that shows that he said wiretapped in the most general sense of the word. Wouldn't we all be surprised were that the case? Because we don't have the information.
Well the FBI has already jumped out to protect themselves.
But do I have to believe the FBI? Do I have to believe the CIA?
But I got to believe the FBI on this one.
But here, in my best interest.
But the explanation, at least offered by the media and the Democrats in this particular case, is that, well, we wouldn't do that. That was against the law. You need a decision by the FISA court.
Well, wait a minute.
You don't necessarily need a decision by the FISA court to do something. Legally, you do.
Yeah, right.
Legally, you do.
Yes.
But you could have some guy
way down the level who has access to
information.
That was exactly my reaction.
He picks up the call and calls the New York Times.
Yes. Right.
Not a FISA court.
And we can they can destroy anybody they want to destroy.
Yes.
Here is something we know. I think we all know this. I don't think this is. I hope this is not controversial. We know that people with access to these transcripts of the, say, presidential phone calls with the Prime Minister of Australia, right?
Right.
Okay. Those are, by their very nature, secret, and depending on the other head of government, potentially top secret, okay? And they never get out. And none of us ever heard about any phone call of Barack Obama
never.
With anybody, okay?
No, we did
and
about
within
him.
The
or
first
George Bush.
Or George Bush or George Bush or Bill,
Bill
Clinton,
Clinton.
Et cetera. Okay, never happened before.
Happen.
Does not happen. You talk about the tight circle around the president's daily brief group, et cetera. Doesn't happen. Okay. Except when you're Donald Trump. Except when you're Donald Trump. And
hold
on a second.
Yes, let him
by its nature, it has to have been leaked.
It has to.
By a person with clearance to have it. And that group is, I can tell you, very small.
Small.
Very small. A couple at the State Department, a couple at DOD, CIA, over at NSC, the National Security mm-hmm. Council staff gets there. Okay. But
in the
you're
DNI's
talking about
office.
Two or three dozen people. Max, they're the people, someone in that group did it.
Yeah.
The fact that the fact that a leak occurred speaks to, again, the failing thus far to really shore up his administration.
No.
To have people, I certainly think that it does. Because if it's only under Donald Trump, I think the tone that he set prior to becoming president has created an environment where he has almost undermined himself. And so there are people who are in his administration who feel comfortable leaking information. And to me, that speaks to a question of leadership.
We can't. But the comments that he made during the campaign, they may have upset people in the intelligence community. They don't like the idea that the American people chose Donald Trump, at least the Electoral College chose Donald Trump to be president. They're resentful, and they want to embarrass yeah. the new incoming president. And by the way, on top of that, it's more than just embarrassment. In the case of Michael Flynn, which will be a focal point tomorrow when James Comey testifies before the House Intelligence Committee, the person who released the information about Michael Flynn committed a crime.
Absolutely.
That's a crime. That is the only crime mm-hmm. that we know about. Everything else is Democratic and media speculation that there was a crime, there was influence with everything else. But the point is, there was a crime there.
Well, it's a crime to release these transcripts,
yes,
too.
I understand
and that very
that.
Well may be the case, but it's still, at the end of the day, President Trump and his administration have to figure out how to create an environment where that does not become an acceptable thing.
Oh, you
thing.
Made me do it. It sounds like, you know, the devil
no,
made
it's
me
not,
do it. It
no,
like
so what? Are, so what's their alternative? The alternative is they're going to continue to have leaks, and it's going to continue to undermine the legitimacy and the effectiveness of the administration. So
which undermines the legitimacy and effectiveness of the United States.
But your argument
and
is that they're
and that's the goal. That's the goal of the opposition.
But your argument is that I'm going to, the people undermining him are forced to undermine him by his own.
I believe that there are folks who were there specifically to set up the president. And I'll give you the examples are Ben Rhodes's deputies who, quote, burrowed in. They changed their status from political to career. Then they stayed on and mm-hmm. they had a wide circle of friends in the Washington press corps that had been covering Barack Obama, Ben Rhodes. And they were part of what Ben Rhodes once derisively called an echo chamber. They stayed in their positions, and one about a week after Trump came in and the other about 3 weeks after Trump came in made these very big, these were Washington boomlets of their saying, oh, this administration is worse than anything I've ever imagined, and I'm now offended and I'm going to walk out. And so they made these very big Sarah Bernhardt departures from the White
Kelly
House.
Kelly Yates.
Right. And so I'm looking at this saying, there are some people out there acting strategically to delegitimize our president, and who you might like, you might hate, but he is our president. Okay. And some of the people who are doing that are in the intelligence community. Now, it also happens that Trump doesn't like the intelligence. So this is a whole toxic mix in here. And I agree, Trump's got to be a better leader. But I also think that we've got something rotten in the intelligence community. There are people at that high level who would do things like this to a president, any president.
When we come back, we're going to talk about this climate that exists and what happens when the president is presented with information or intelligence about North Korea and their capabilities. That when we come back.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
The biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and before the break, I posed the question. We have an environment now where the president has reservations about the intelligence community. The intelligence community has some reservations about the president, if you read the tea leaves that are out there in the media. And yet we have, in North Korea, we have a very dangerous administration, and the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, was on the road this past week, and he issued a warning to North Korea, saying that we're, you know, this period of relaxation or
strategic patience
that era is over. So the President of the United States is going to have to make some ongoing decisions as it relates to how we deal with North Korea. Does he believe the intelligence community? Is he going to believe Rex Tillerson? I mean, do we know? Does Tillerson have the ear of the president, and can he talk sense to the president of the United States? Does anybody want to render a verdict on
that? I wish I had faith one way or the other.
I'm going to trust the intelligence community on this. What I'm more concerned about is what's the strategic direction that we go in dealing with North Korea? Because you can't sort of view them in a rational choice model, because their leader is fairly irrational. And I think we have to be prepared for anything. I think it helps having sort of a career diplomat as your Secretary of State who can gently navigate some things that you do in diplomacy. I don't know that Tillerson has that experience. But more importantly, I think DOD has got to be ready to drop the hammer on this guy in seconds. And I don't know that this president knows exactly our sort of range of options best to do that.
Chris Roebling.
I think that Rex Tillerson has a lot of experience dealing with things like China, things at this level of subtlety and significance. I think that this is just why you want a president and an intelligence community to either get along or keep quiet about it, so that one cannot be played off against the other. And what we need is a visualization of where we are after the crisis. And it's going to have to be with the Kim family out of Korea and South Korea with a major role and a lot of assurances to China that South Korea is not going to play any kind of games that would show up China, right? Because that's not going to get us anywhere. China has to be recognized.
Why would China want to do that?
Because
for the last several years, China has always been held up as the country that's got to apply pressure to make North Korea. Why would they do that?
I believe that North Korea – well, I think that the entire structure of Northeast Asian sort of security relationships was thrown up into the wind by Madeleine Albright and Bill Clinton. I don't think that George W. Bush – ever got around to focusing on it, and when he did, they made a mistake in terms of putting diplomacy ahead of sanctions on North Korea, so that didn't help, and then there was Obama. So the whole Northeast Asian situation post-end of Cold War has been ill-defined, and we're now reaping part of that whirlwind, and I think the Chinese are sick of it, too.
Amara.
Yeah. I agree. I think that that broader point is actually my bigger concern, and which is why when Rex Tillerson was being held up for Secretary of State, I did express reservations. Because understanding how the dynamics in the region are changing, a lot of things have happened over the last 10 years, 20 years, and do we have the capacity with someone who was not a career diplomat, and there were questions about the depth of his understanding of what's happening in the region, that was a concern for me, because we do have to move in a way that is very, I mean, this is very sensitive, and the relationships that we have to maintain. So my concern is that if he's able to, if my concern is how do we manage the changing dynamics in a way that is not detrimental.
But again, as Chris just said, I mean, what we have here is we have three or four administrations with all professional diplomats as Secretary of State. They created this mess.
Yes.
By being diplomatic. I mean, Wendy Sherman. They created this circumstance where they just said, well, let's keep them quiet. Let's give them some money. We gave them a lot of money.
Yeah.
We thought that they were gonna use their power for good, and they used it. They poured it into military. Those were the diplomats that made those deals, and this is where we are now. So I'm not sure that you've got to be a professional diplomat.
Means is we have to rely even more heavily on the expertise of Rex Tillerson and the intelligence community as a guide. And so, I mean, that's
and also, you know, if I may say, we always in these situations have to have very close relations with our allies. So the South Koreans who are in the midst of the epochal political crisis. They're going through Watergate on steroids.
Times 10.
Which is really sad, because this is when we need them
to be stable.
It would be helpful. But then there are the Japanese, who are not the greatest when it comes to the Korean reasons we all understand. But there are other factors, actors in that region, and we've got to have active diplomacy. So it's tough.
As we are reaching out trying to get China to assist us, what does Russia want? Mm. What does Russia want from North Korea? Does anybody have an idea
from
on that?
From North Korea?
They don't want anything from North Korea.
They don't. There's nothing North Korea gives them except a distraction to keep our attention focused away from whatever they're doing.
Russia wants to be sure that the energy in Siberia gets sold to the people in China. That's Russia's Asian issue, and the one element of that is the actual border between China and Russia, which, as you know, goes back to the Regent Sophia, who was Peter the Great's older sister, and has just been renewed, was renewed like 10 years ago, for 25 years. So in 15 years, Russia has to deal with China on the physical border.
Mm-hmm. But if
Korea is a non-event for Russia.
If we are looking down the road and saying to North Korea that North Korea represents a potential threat, it could present a threat to the western part of the United States, certainly to Seoul, certainly to
Canada.
So the point is, if that exists, and I think probably we'd agree that maybe they would be more likely to issue or initiate a nuclear strike than Iran or anyone else.
Oh, yeah.
So the question is, do we sit by and do nothing and wait for them to act, or do we preemptively strike them? That's the question. We'll talk about it in the next hour of Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Is just a really, really, really good guy. The term good egg isn't enough to describe him. He's also certified organic and free range. Rich puts the cap back on everything. The toothpaste, the olive oil, the shampoo, everything. He lets his 10-year-old nephew beat him at virtual tennis, even though he can straight up slay his 10-year-old nephew in virtual tennis. When the toilet paper is running low, Rich replaces the roll on the actual holder, not just on the back of the toilet. Rich is texting and driving. Rich? No. What are you doing, Rich? I was just telling everyone how great you are. Texting and driving makes good people look bad. Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people. Thank you.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Hey, everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Bruce Dumont, we continue on our show this evening, and we were talking about North Korea before the break. By the way, let me just mention again, if you're tuning in to hear Roger Stone, he was supposed to be on this evening for this hour, and we have received word that he has had to cancel, so he will not be on this week. He said that he may be back next week, but we'll let you know if that happens the case. So no Roger Stone tonight, but again, we'll continue with our scintillating discussion. And by the way, we were right on the cusp of a huge war with North Korea, and we're going to discuss the ramifications of North Korea and the difficult time that the president has. Obviously, he's got to be listening to the intelligence community, and we have this potentially ticking time bomb called North Korea. And Phil Beverly, you're one of our card-carrying liberals this evening, but you said in the last break that the Defense Department has to be ready to lower the hammer on this guy. Now, elaborate what you mean by lowering the hammer.
You're going to have to degrade his ability to put any nukes in the air, because he is the leader of a country that will use nuclear weapons indiscriminately. He'll launch them against Seoul, against Tokyo. Once he gets the technology to launch them against Hawaii and California, he's a guy who would do that. We've had nukes since 45 and that, and they've only been used twice in combat, and it was us, and justifiably, we can't let him do that.
You said also something, Chris, during the break, that the way to deal with it is you've got to take the leader out.
Well,
how do you go about taking the leader out? I mean, in many cases, we have attempted to assassinate leaders with some success and not success, but are you proposing that?
No.
How do you take them out?
Well, I think that we've got to get a consensus, and that's the only reason I think that's possible now is because they are so obstreperous, and they are, as Phil says, they will use nuclear weapons. It's a question of when, not if. And I think everybody, South Korea, Japan, even Russia, a neighbor, they have, you share a border, short border with North Korea, understands. So you have to apply an enormous amount of sanctions. You have to make life incredibly difficult for the folks who are benefiting from the regime. And you have to create an exit strategy. Where are they going to go? They are not – you can't have them stay. They have to go to China and live under China protection. And you have to absolutely get South Korea into a new relationship with China so that reunification can take place on the peninsula without, you see, China has never wanted an actual democracy
on their border. That's exactly
absolutely
right.
And so South,
that's why
right, South
they
Korea.
So they're not going to want to do this.
I think South Korea has to say, look, we're going to do our thing over here, and we are not going to interfere in your relations. And they're going to have a cordon sanitaire between the two.
Do you agree that it's when, not if, for North Korea doing something stupid with their weapons, Amira?
I'm inclined to agree. I think over the last couple of decades, it's become increasingly clear that a lot of the strategies that have been tried have been ineffective. We've seen the North Korean administration it simply hasn't been effective. So I do think it's more a question of when, and our response is going to be key, but also that exit strategy is going to be absolutely critical. I do think that China will recognize that having North Korea as it is just not beneficial, and that they do have an interest in making sure that any reunification strategy, as long as it doesn't threaten or they feel comfortable that it's not going to threaten their political situation, I think they'll be amenable to it.
So as one of our other liberals on the panel tonight, then you agree that a first strike against North Korea at some point could be the only thing left for the United States to do?
I am very hesitant about preemptive strikes, particularly because of what happened in Iraq, because of the nature of the intelligence that we have. I mean, there would have to be rock solid evidence that any strike would be absolutely necessary.
We know they have
Neptune spear type intelligence.
And we know that they have missiles, and the missiles every time they launch are getting better, and they're going further, and they're working on miniaturization. That'll be the key. Once they can make the bomb small enough to go onto that particular missile, then they can launch it all over the world. And that's going to be – so we know these things to be facts. I'm convinced we could destroy their economy within months, but only if China – what's that?
Isn't their economy already destroyed?
Oh, of course. But they get by because China provides them enough just to keep alive. If China would join us and essentially blockade the country – then they wouldn't get all the good things that they want, all the whiskey. And
I actually think it's less the country and more so the elites in North Korea that benefit
from
the things.
Keep in mind that the entire society has been cordoned off from the rest of the world. They believe that the rest of the world is after them. And, of course, we're going to make it true if we would strike them first. And I don't think there is any degree to which the leader – he won't care how bad it gets, how badly the people are treated.
Let
them starve to death.
And he has to try, and
then the rest of the world will become very guilty that we're starving their people to death. And well,
are there? You say that basically they're basically choking to death, and the air hose is coming from China. Are there other countries? There certainly are. And would it be in their best interest to create an option or an alternative for North Korea to help its people, because it's a huge – if anybody could get a job there, it could be another huge market.
Well, yeah.
It's South Korea. South Korea understands the significance of a reunified peninsula and also understands the significance of not engaging China. And so South Korea – the problem at South Korea, as we said, it's in the middle of the biggest political crisis in the history of South Korea, and there have been big ones. And this is cataclysmic, and we don't know who's going to come out on the other side.
By putting pressure on China to cut off and drive North Korea into the sea, if you will. By doing that, there has to be a role for South Korea to play.
Yeah.
But you have said that the Chinese don't want a democracy on their border. And I guess my question is, since South Korea has been a pretty remarkable story of world economy and development, they've come a long way from the Korean War, why would China want another competitor that could challenge them on the worldwide stage?
That's why North Korea is where it is today.
Exactly.
Right? The other country that's dealing with them is Iran, because Iran wants the nuclear information.
Syria. We know that Syria was in the midst of purchasing nuclear equipment technology from North Korea. I want to say North Korea's other, I would say, unwanted prospect for China is the collapse of its economy totally, so that the North Koreans cross the river
in huge
and
numbers.
Just, you know, as refugees flood northern China.
It is literally across the river.
Right. It's
like the United States and Mexico.
In certain areas, there are no fences, no walls.
If I could go anywhere in the world, I would love to go to the DMZ. I would like to experience life on the DMZ. I want to hear about it when we come back. Back shortly, 1-800-723-8029.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school. Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
We are back. This is Bruce Dumont, coast to coast and border to border on America's great radio stations, including a Sirius XM satellite radio, 124, as well as television stations in Chicago. And we're now on the air in Houston. Nice to be on in Houston. Mike Miller, I said before the break that I would love to go to the DMZ, which is where North Korea and South Korea are literally nose to nose with the United States involvement there as well. You've been there. Describe what you saw when you went there. It's supposedly the most tense place on Earth.
It is very tense. And we started, we went to this train station that has a station that is opened to the north, but nobody's ever gone there. They built this station in anticipation of being able to have a train ride from England all the ways to South Korea. But it's not open, and they're there hoping in anticipation. We get onto the bus, and they tell us, this is as a tourist, that you are not allowed to take pictures. And I learned that. I should have been more careful.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting in and we get into the area where you can observe the North Korea, the DMZ itself. And you can see that out on the roadways where we were on, you would go in 5 feet from the side of the road, and there were barbed wires and there were landmines. And you were told, if you go in there, you're going to die. Mm. And so we couldn't go past these landmines. And we were told again to watch the cameras. We went up to look over to the north, and there's a wall. So if you're short, you can't see anything. The wall is about probably five and a half feet high. But you must stand back 5 feet to take any pictures whatsoever. You're not allowed to take a picture at the wall with your camera. You have to be back 5 feet, which means you can see almost nothing. And on the south side, when you look over, there's a forest. And on the north, they wiped out all of the trees so they can see if somebody's trying to get in or out. And, of course, there was this very large flag on the south, and the north didn't like that, so they built a bigger flag. But the tension there, and we went into the tunnel, and we actually went into the tunnel that were built during the war, and we went until a certain spot, and on the other side of that tunnel was North Korea. So we were able to go underground right up until the North Korean border. Then we had to turn around and go back. And I like to take pictures, and I was told there are certain pictures we could take. So I took some pictures of a sign that said military base or something like this. And I turned around to walk back to the bus, and I hear pitter-patter of feet, and they get closer and closer. And here's four military that surround me with their AK-47s. and they couldn't speak a word of English. And they pointed at my camera, and they insisted that I open it up to show them which pictures I took. And luckily, it was digital, and I was able to go through it, and I took a picture of a sign. Had I turned it to the side to take a picture of where they were playing football, they would have taken my camera. It is that tense.
And you probably would have gone to prison.
It's possible. I could have been arrested.
Wouldn't be here tonight.
And I was told, of course, the big dumb dummy that I am, I should have kept the camera shackled.
In the early days of the Reagan administration, there was a classic picture of Ronald Reagan looking through binoculars, and he was looking into North Korea.
Yep.
I want to get back to our earlier discussion about this president at this moment in time. Does this president need to travel more? Does he need to see the world in a bigger way so that when decisions are made, it may not be the photo op of going to the DMZ, but I'm saying, does he need to experience more of the world stage, or do you think that would further either embarrass the country or show him up?
I don't know that it embarrasses the country. I don't know that he needs to see it as much as he needs to understand it and understand the complexity of relationships between countries and regions and some historical stuff. For a guy who says he doesn't read much, spends a lot of time watching TV, okay, broaden and deepen your understanding is what I would say. And if you can do that in D.C. or Mar-a-Lago or wherever, that's great. You don't have to jump on Air Force One and travel the world. Being here, you can do that, but it's understanding complexity that's important.
It's a little late, I think, in the game for President Trump to begin soul-searching and traveling around to understand the world. That's why it's so important that who he surrounds himself with in his administration is key and has that knowledge and understanding. The other thing is that he's a very linear thinker, so he's all about the deal. He talks in terms of business and negotiation and very transactional. And a lot of what we're dealing with when you're dealing with other countries, when you're dealing with governments and other cultures, it is very much nuanced, and it is about relationships. And that's a skill set that's a weakness, I think, that he has, but he can make up for it with his administration, members of his administration.
Chris Roebling.
Well, he's been all over the world. I mean, he's been throughout the Gulf. He's been throughout Southeast Asia. I think he's been, you talk about Hong Kong and Kowloon and all of those. Yeah. Everywhere there's a possibility for a 5 or a 7-star resort. So I'm not kidding. I mean, he's been there. Mm-hmm. And in many of those places, he's licensed his name. So he has this, he's a worldly guy, right? He's a worldly guy. But I agree that he doesn't really have a conceptual approach. And the transactional nature of his approach, unfortunately, I think, at least in business, he's been keyed to, I will be the winner in all of my deals. Mm-hmm. And in politics, to say nothing of statecraft, which is about 40 stories above politics, you've got to find ways so that the Chinese feel good about accepting the Kim family. Mm-hmm. And they're going to get something in recompense for that. South Korea is going to get something, but they're also going to take a new obligation.
Well, does he have the ability to put that deal together, though?
He hasn't shown it yet. I've become a big fan of Scott Adams and he's a professional on the art of persuasion, and he is convinced that Donald Trump is a master persuader. So I think that Trump could actually pull some of these things off.
I'm going to say something very weird. And a few years ago, when Dennis Rodman got a lot of publicity when he went to North Korea they're simpatico. Okay, they both may be a little wacky, and I'm not suggesting
a little.
I'm not suggesting that Dennis Rodman becomes the ambassador to North Korea.
Or maybe
he is the ambassador,
but in his mind. Yeah, but he's got to go through Amorosa. He's got to figure it all out.
Oh God!
Here's the question: what if Donald Trump got together with the leader of North Korea? What if they met?
Oh no! Oh no! No! No!
What if
no?
They,
can't.
No! If they
that,
met?
That can't. That's impossible. The president of the United States is not going to meet with a 10-pot dictator.
That's right. Never. You don't degrade the office of the presidency like that by legitimizing that guy.
That's right. Obama did.
We have not heard from we've not heard from Amara.
I find the notion fascinating, actually.
There you go.
I find it fascinating. And part of it is because so much about this last year and a half has been so unprecedented. I just don't know what the consequence would be.
To execute his uncle,
yes,
used a mortar.
Yeah.
Anti-aircraft weapon.
No, that's the more recent one. He wanted to obliterate his uncle.
Yeah.
And so they took
a
target practice on a hill, these hills that
they
Michael
also used. They used a hungry dog.
Just recently they used anti-aircraft weapons.
I want to hear from Professor Miller, because this is not a discussion you're going to hear on Meet the Press.
So
what's your thought?
The
apparent absurdity of the president and the leader of North
is
Korea
absurd.
Getting together to have a meeting.
He's a monster.
Yeah.
He is in charge of a country which he has impoverished. No, you can't give him – you just can't do it.
You can't give him any legitimacy.
I'm not saying it was a good idea.
I just want to say
– This is a conversation
you
show.
You evoke the Reagan image, which was – actually toned down because of the prior kerfuffle, which took place under Carter. Who remembers Zbigniew Brzezinski going to the DMZ and holding
a rifle,
and looking through the scope of the rifle? That picture was on the front page of the Washington Post, and he got all kinds of trouble.
Jorge, listening to us in El Paso, Texas on KTSM. Is it Jorge or George?
Jorge.
Okay, go ahead.
Good evening, Chicago.
Hello.
As the representative of American point of view here in Western Texas, I want to comment on the idea that our president could meet with the leader of North Korea.
Yes.
Because the political strategy of North Korea would not allow for its leader to meet our leader because they don't have a military strategy. They have a political strategy because they're up in the north on the peninsula, right, as a bloc. And just because they are where they are and they are developing weapons by which they can fire across Japan, and when they acquire the ability to fire across Japan, then they are politically set. And as a consequence, they then will be able to thwart Western interests up in that region of the world because they will sit amongst China and Russia and will be able to confer either Russia or China in their interest against Western interests if Western interests are opposed to both Russian interests and Chinese interests as it develops.
Jorge, let me interrupt for a second because we're running out of time in this segment. Let me ask you the question I asked Chris and Amara. Do you believe that a military confrontation with North Korea we should be talking about when, not if?
No, the United States can't engage North Korea. The only thing they can do is engage them politically on their terms in cooperation with both China and Russia.
Okay, thanks for your call. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, got one more call on this subject, and then we'll switch gears, and we're going to talk about something a little bit easier to resolve, and that is repair and replace Obama. And reform. Restore and replace. Something like that. R&R. It's got
Obamacare.
Obamacare.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight.
You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's begin this segment by going to the calls. Let's go to Meridian, Idaho, listening to us on KBOI tonight. It's Bob. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey.
Hello.
How are you guys doing?
We're doing fine.
I had to laugh listening to you talking about how Trump is transactional and that's bad. And you pointy-headed liberals, even including the Republicans from Illinois that couldn't get a dog catcher elected in a place where there's a million rabid dogs, telling Donald Trump how to do business or relate to other countries is a laugh.
Well, I will say in response to the caller that no one said that the transactional nature of what he did is bad. So perhaps you can rewind the show and take a listen. We're talking about the nuances of relationships with different countries and leadership and how it's a much more nuanced than a linear approach to
a nuance when you're dealing in
I disagree.
Diplomacy is war in a different form.
No, that's not true. Who is this guy again?
Bob,
this is Bob in Idaho.
First of all,
Bob,
we're going to let some of our pointy.
My family's from Pocatello and Blackfoot, all right? So you might be from Idaho, but other people are too. Number two, I'm going to tell you something. Clausewitz said war is a
Carl von Clausewitz on war.
Von who wrote
Krieg.
On War.
Okay.
Along with Machiavelli and Sun Tzu, probably three of the greatest theorists. But anyway, said war is continuation of diplomacy by other means.
Yes.
Okay? And, I said that Trump lacks a colligatory concept. I stand by that. He is transactional. And I said in those transactions, I believe he has sought to be the winner. That's how he ended up with all of the money he got. God bless him. God bless him. He did it legally, and he's a great businessman. Now he's president, and he's going to be dealing with people who are not, you know, cement haulers or whatever. You know, he's not dealing with the iron workers anymore. He's not dealing with Chase Manhattan Bank anymore. He's dealing with North Korea, the People's Republic of China, et cetera.
Go ahead, Bob.
Who is he dealing with?
Well, we were talking about how the United States...
brilliant people like the communist Chinese that haven't figured out communism doesn't work yet.
Works for them. I mean, for the leadership it does. Doesn't for the people. I agree with you there.
It works for their country? Do you really think it works for their country?
Oh, no. It doesn't work for the people. It works for the leadership. I agree, yeah.
Well, Bob, let me ask you the question. Do you believe that a first strike, perhaps, against North Korea is something that is inevitable, in your opinion?
Well, I think they should locate him and blow him up just like he did his uncle.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Well, we have that diplomatic effort.
I know that would upset all the world leaders, quote, but for the last 35 years, what have the world leaders done about the Kim Jong-il and his father and his grandfather? What have they done about him?
Not much. Nothing. And I'm not so sure that the world leaders would be upset with your suggestion, by the way. So
absolutely.
Thank you very much for your call. We do appreciate it. One issue that we've not touched base on, that is obviously the efforts by the Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare. The conservatives are pushing a different position.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that, and you got your head in your
head
is in your hand. Oh. What are the Republicans up to, Chris? You seem like beside yourself. We've just solved
it's a great
the issue
plan.
Of North. We've
They've
just
had 6 years to come up with
North
it.
Korea,
it's a great plan.
And now we're talking about the Republican congressional.
I just
battle.
Wanted to say I was sitting in for you on the Sunday night that Obamacare passed and was finally approved by Congress. Do you remember that? I had an all-female panel. It may have been the first all-female panel. And we were watching it on this on the
big screen,
the promo or the monitors. You know, if ever there was something where the Republican Party should have its act together, have its kit pulled together, and be ready. And I'm very disappointed in Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. I mean, look, I'm not going to come on this show as a Republican and say, oh, no, this is great. This is great. These guys ought to be on item number 7 of a 23-item Republican wish list that we've all been thinking about since Reagan passed on. And instead, you know,
you've got what you've
Chuck
got now.
Schumer is running around and we're all trying to get our Adidas on in the locker room.
Mike Miller.
Well, I don't know if any of you take, are you in Obamacare? Either anybody here in Obamacare? My son's
Medicare.
Are. You're in Medicare.
It's a disaster.
Okay. It's yes. The increase last year for my son in Illinois was 107%.
But what
that means
do the what
the Republicans have failed
since then.
If they had
some people are actually saying that Obamacare is still working.
If they
it's
had
not
talked
working,
to
it is failing.
If the Republicans had cared about really doing this well, they would have found 100 examples of innocent, loyal people who are trying to do the Obamacare thing. There are millions of people who have lost their plan or lost their doctor or been stuck with, you know, unconscionable increases in the premiums or unconscionable increases in the deductibles. And the Republicans have hidden all of that under a bushel. It's not a part of the national.
But the president supposedly is twisting the arms, taking them to the bowling alley in the White House, trying to convince Republicans to support this Ryan plan. Yeah. Is that a good idea, or is he asking Republicans to commit suicide?
Great idea.
Well,
put the suicide vest on for 2018. It's ridiculous. They've had 6 years to come up with a plan, and they've managed again to have another self-inflicted wound with this utterly ridiculous plan that their own caucus can't even get behind.
I'm just glad that we can have a really honest conversation about this, because I do think that the biggest issue for me is that to have made such a big deal about the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare, and to recognize that there are some flaws with it, but to have had the amount of time that has passed and to not have walked into this administration with some plan in place that had already gotten some measure of support that they can just go down the line, to me is absolutely appalling. I would have thought, based upon the rhetoric leading up to the President Trump becoming president, that they would have walked in with a very clear plan that they can just begin to execute.
The pop culture way has been, here's the plan.
Would you like to come to a Republican caucus meeting?
Maybe
we could get you in there.
As an economist, Mike Miller to you, from DePaul University. As an economist, what is the best aspect of the Republican House plan, and what is the worst part of it from an economic standpoint?
I can't answer that. Well, Partly because it's like a blob. I don't know exactly.
It allows the insurance companies to get to prices. And that's, I believe, as a econ major, you know, if the market can operate and come to an equilibrium, then government, in the personage of our professor here, can come in and help people who don't.
If the price
is here and people of lesser means can only get to here, then the government should come in and give them vouchers so that they can select something.
That was what I argued from the very start, right. And it just didn't happen.
And instead we had all of these permutations and backflips.
But when the Congressional Budget Office says that 24 million people are not going to be covered, isn't that like taking cyanide?
No, but see, that part of the issue is, in terms of those 24 million, that's just, part of it is people exercising their judgment that they don't need health insurance. If you're young, the chances are you're going to need a lot of health insurance is very low, and they can make that decision.
But that's the headline that's out there. That's not allowed to do under Obamacare. It's a devastating headline.
And these young people have to pay premiums that allow it to be much lower for the older who are the sicker.
I want to ask the Democrats, because we're about out of time on this segment. Speaking of devastating headlines, President Trump paid $38 million in taxes. That's the headline. Donald Trump paid $38 million in taxes.
Yeah.
How do you think the average person feels about that headline? That's a lot of money.
How much did he make?
Well, there was 150. Out of 150, he paid $38 million?
He paid a higher rate than Bernie Sanders and a higher rate than Barack Obama and a higher rate than one other
and
big
what
liberal.
Was, and what was the time period?
Buffett, yeah, Warren Buffett.
And what was the time period? That was for a year?
It was 2005.
Okay. So
he actually made $250 million.
I'm talking about, right now, I'm just talking about the dueling headlines.
Right.
Well, what it
sometimes
did is
a headline can be devastating. People remember that number like they're going to remember $24 million.
What it did, from my view, is that it weakens. It demystified a lot of the mystery around President Trump's taxes, and it weakened the argument that he hasn't paid his fair share only because people see $38 million and they say, wow, that sounds like a lot. Not necessarily because they're doing the layers of analysis about percentages and so on and so forth. So I do think it weakened, at least on the Democratic side, the arguments around his taxes.
So
and I think
Rachel
for average
Maddow
people
gave him an issue. Rachel Maddow let him off the hook.
Yep, she was gonna do him in, and she did herself in. Yeah,
she's down there with Geraldo. Yeah. At 12th and Michigan,
the vault,
and it was empty
in the Al Capone vault. Yeah.
And
that's
it was
where
empty.
Rachel, I think that's where we'll find her.
That
shortly.
Vault story for Geraldo Rivera was the best thing that ever happened to his entire career.
I know.
The most watched syndicated show
it's
in
crazy.
The history.
Yep.
He
made
of
a
television.
Fortune on that, didn't he?
Guests, you have been a wonderful panel tonight. Thanks for being with us. I'm Bruce Dumont.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair. See Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back. Nice to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. I want to pick up our conversation because one thing we've not talked, we talked a little bit about the budget early on, but do you think one of the unreported stories of the week was what the Fed was up to, Mike?
Yeah, the Federal Reserve looking at the economy, and I know Chris doesn't necessarily agree, they see nothing but strength. Inflation is very near the rate which the Fed wants, which is 2%. The economy, something called U3, the measurement of unemployment, is near what we would call full employment, 4.7%. Now, I know you
participation.
I understand.
I'm not going to say one thing in October about Obama and another
no,
thing.
I'm just saying.
Come on.
I'm just. These are the data.
Yeah.
So the Fed believes it has to normalize interest rates. It has to raise them up to where it is what is called neutral.
This is
so
like,
that you make a decision not based upon the interest rate, you make it based upon the investment itself. The Fed wants to be neutral in terms of growth so that the unemployment remains near full and inflation remains near 2%. And the only thing they raised rates and they made it clear that they probably will do it again soon.
Phil Beverly.
And this is why I think economists just have a real blind spot in not understanding what really happens. The data is fine. The data is what the data is.
Yep.
And people's perception of the economy, I think, is markedly different than the Fed's perception of the data.
You look at Consumer Report, it's the highest it's been since 2001. Consumer confidence is the highest it's been since 2001.
Well,
there is one thing that's the problem,
okay.
And that is the income of households are still not rising.
Right.
That's
why the average American
citizen does not see what I'm talking about.
I'm going to tell you
and
another
that's
problem.
What
Sam,
has
let me
got,
tell you another problem.
But
here's
this is
another
when
problem.
That might finally begin to grow.
I want to ask you a question about the budget cuts. During the campaign, Donald Trump talked a lot about helping inner cities and helping reaching out to African Americans and raising their aspirations. With the budget cuts he's made, how is he going to make a case that the African Americans who did support him, although the numbers were small, that maybe they've made the right choice?
Well, he can't. And I think what he's prioritized as far as focusing with these first, at least his first 100 days of his administration, evidences that. I mean, if he had wanted to really move forward on that particular talking point from the campaign, he probably would have focused on infrastructure and working across the aisle to put something forward that would lead to hiring, particularly in the African-American community. But I think the focus on cutting from Meals on Wheels and cutting from the arts and public broadcasting, it just shows that his priorities are not focused on.
I don't see the connection between that and the problems in the inner city.
Because the focus would be on the things that would actually create jobs and create opportunities in cities.
Fix taxes.
Broadcasting doesn't create
fix
jobs.
Fix taxes.
But it's about priorities.
Well, I agree. Fix taxes.
Fix taxes. Then you can go to infrastructure because tax thing is fixed, the job thing makes more sense.
His principal outreach into the African American communities is through the Department of Education supporting charter school initiatives in all 50 states. And that is going to have an enormous impact once it gets going.
Isn't that one of the increases, education?
Yeah. I believe this is a civil rights issue of the 21st century, and I believe that this can have legs. Like so much else in the Trump administration, you don't hear a lot about what they're doing. You're not getting any kind of narrative out of the education department, and it's a little bit forlorn.
Maybe because they've got a secretary who doesn't have a clue about governance or messaging.
That's not true.
But the emphasis, the emphasis from the administration, I believe, should have focused more on the economic side and the job side, because that was a lot of what his talking points were as it relates to
community. And it hasn't.
And if he followed through on that, then he could have. Then he would have had more of a standing, I think, with the African American community. Even with regard to the focus on charter schools and vouchers and that whole thing. Here, for example, in Chicago, where most of Chicago public schools, now there's been proliferation of charter schools. It really has not helped to give families the kinds of options that they should have. So I don't know that that would actually resonate as much as if he had pushed something on the economic development
side. A question that I want to come back to, you mentioned this earlier in the broadcast. I'm going to ask you, Professor Miller. You talked about James Clapper, the former head of DNI. He said two things about James Clapper. A couple of weeks ago on Meet the Press, he said that when he left, there was no evidence of any collusion between the Russians and the Trump campaign.
Yes.
He said that emphatically, and some people don't believe him, and that's going to be one thing that will be discussed in the hearings that will commence tomorrow. Also, a couple of years ago, he lied under oath, and he perjured himself in congressional testimony, when he said he didn't know anything about any NSA wiretapping, and then the story broke about 2 days later. Mm-hmm. So which James Clapper do you think is going to show up, and which James Clapper are you going to believe?
You're torn
between this.
I am, but see,
and
that's the problem
bit
when
like
anybody.
James Clapper.
Thank you. I know they're bald headed. No, I agree.
Bit.
Yeah, no problem with that. That's the problem when you lie. When you get lied, no one's going to believe you from that point on.
Forward.
And I do believe that he's correct that there's nothing, there was no collusion between the Russians and Trump. Did the Russians try to get into some emails and put out truth? Yeah, they did that. But there's nothing that there was some kind of nefarious deal between the Russians and so forth to have Trump win. If anything, it doesn't even make any sense because he was not supposed to win. Why would you put all of your eggs into a basket that's not going to perform?
Yeah, the whole
idea is just so stupid.
You have, by the way,
we've got
less than a minute left. I want to just tomorrow you're going to have dueling hearings. You're going to have the first of the Neil Gorsuch hearings to be on the United States Supreme Court, and James Comey is going to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
For fireworks, watch Comey.
Both of them are going to be on TV. Which hearing are you going to be watching?
Gorsuch Comey. Is a brilliant guy. He's going to be very quiet.
That's right.
Comey is a lot more interesting.
Gorsuch is anticlimactic. You got to watch Comey.
Okay. That's right. If we're watching Comey, do we think that Comey – one quick question. Do we think Comey will say something tomorrow that will absolutely positively end all the speculation about Donald Trump and alleged collusion with the Russians? Yes or no?
No.
No.
Not yet.
On that note, we're out of time. Our thanks to Fritz Goldman and Colin Bobbitt and the ever-popular Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Is just a really, really, really good guy. The term 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 good guy.